the electorate. I hope you're not too exhausted. I hear some people saying I need a month's rest. We sympathize and empathize. We have received from Mr. Labuschagne and his team the proposed amendments to the State Liability Amendment Bill. So I'm going to ask him to just quickly take us through the document in front of us. It's called Working Document as on 17/5/2011.
Thank you, Chairperson. I realize this document is fairly complicated in the sense that it's single underlining, double underlining, dotted underlining, but the purpose is the single underlining is as the bill was when it was initially introduced. The double underlining indicates amendments that were affected after some of the previous meetings, and the dotted underlining and words in square brackets with a strike through indicates amendments that the committee proposed on the 21st of April in its last meeting. When the committee eventually, when the committee is going to vote, I will give the committee a clean document, but this was just to, so the committee members can see exactly what changes have been effected since the last meeting. Fine. If we go to page 3 of the document, at the top, at the previous meeting, the committee indicated that the state attorney must be informed of proceedings that have been instituted against the department at the initial stages. So I've included a provision that which provides that the judgment creditor or his or her legal representative must, within 7 days after summons in which the minister has been cited, has been issued, must serve a copy of that summons on the state attorney. I've spoken to the state attorney, Mr. Wilkin, this morning, and he proposed that we, after the word summons, also insert the words on notice, because he showed me the rules and the proceedings are instituted by means of either a summons or by means of a notice. So that is one technical change that I will effect before the committee votes on the bill. That is the only amendment on that page.
Mr. Chair, just on a point of process, are we going to go through all of the amendments first and then comment, or can we ask questions as we go?
Clause by clause. I think so, yeah. Because effectively then at the end of that process we should have covered, we should largely be done.
Sure, just that this issue on your second paragraph here with the bold, for the purpose of subsection 1, minister shall blah blah blah. I'm not sure if I'm misunderstanding, but it seems to me you're changing minister to executive authority and then you're referring to minister again in 2. So is the minister referred to somewhere else? Because from what I read, you're making the paragraph at the top of page 3, paragraph 1, you're taking out minister and putting executive authority, and then you're referring to minister in the next paragraph, being referring to a member of the executive council. So should it not be executive authority instead of minister there as well?
Chairperson, that whole part for the purpose of subsection 1, minister shall, that is being deleted. That whole part in bold, yes.
Hmm.
the formulation, the reference to the judgment creditor at that stage, it's not a judgment creditor. It would be a creditor or a plaintiff or an applicant. Why do we say the judgment creditor at the point of institution of proceedings?
Chairperson, I will, together with the State Attorney and Law Advisors, look into that matter, but it appears to be a valid point. Okay. It was due to my lack of understanding of and practice in civil law.
Look, I mean, I think it's correct, because this was at the, most of the bill relates to what happens after you've got a judgment and you're the judgment creditor. But what we'd said in this point is at the start of any action, we want the state attorney to be aware of any cases. But now, what would we call them? I don't want, can we not resolve this if possible now? Rather than they go away and discuss and then they come back with something and we don't like it. Now, it's basically, yeah, I mean, Debbie has sort of said plaintiff or applicant. It's a civil, I mean, surely it would only be a plaintiff. Mm. In an application, you wouldn't be suing for costs, or would you? Would it be plaintiff or applicant?
There may be a cost order in an application.
Person, maybe some other, I mean, but can we just not look at it now? The person bringing the application, I don't know, I mean, the state attorney deal with it the whole time, so maybe they're the best to designate.
Yeah. I think there's nothing wrong with the plaintiff or applicant.
Plaintiff?
Yeah.
You probably
when you refer to a summons, you've got to refer to an application as well, surely. Because you say 7 days after a summons, should it not be an application as well? He follows the rule. Rule 4.9 refers to the summons or notice instituting such proceeding. So that should cover other types of proceeding.
I see you've got the summons twice, so it would come down, it would be recorded under both, because unless I misunderstood Mr. Labuschagne, he was only referring to the last summons, a copy of the summons or notice, so it would be after a summons or notice of application. And then presumably notice of application rather than just notice. Which is it? I don't know. Is it notice, just notice? Because I mean, Debbie again, I don't know. We seem to have a... because she talks about notice of motion, but that would be with an application. That would also be an application. It would be a notice of application, wouldn't it be?
The rule in the High Court rule says summons or notice instituting such proceedings, which I think would cover just about.
Is notice, through your chair, is notice defined anywhere in the rules?
I think it's self-defining by saying instituting the proceeding.
Mine was more if we just say notice instead of notice instituting the proceedings. But I suppose if that's how it is in the rules, let's go for notice instituting the proceedings. Okay.
Okay, so are we now going clause by clause?
Yes.
Okay. Then the proposed new section 3, subsection 1, there has been no changes, except that we substituted the word shall with must, because that is the latest drafting form. What we basically provide is that unless the procedure, we provide that there may be no execution attachment against property of the state unless the procedure for payment as provided for in this section has not been complied with. So we still go start from the premises, no attachment, no execution, subject to what the state paying. If they don't pay, then execution. Then we can go to the...
Ma, one general procedural issue. There's a letter here which I hadn't seen before from the Minister of Finance with amendments. It appears from my superficial reading that they have been included. It is dated 3rd of May. But it's now the 24th. Those of us that were not involved in elections, can we assume Mr. Labuschagne's read it, and if there are issues of disagreement, he would refer them, he would refer us to those? Or can then the Mr. Nombalo or Janine come in if there's an issue that they're not in agreement with, because we haven't had a chance to read this. We've only got it now. That was one. And then two is it'll come up later, but just deal with it at this section. Okay, it's final court order. And we've then deleted later on the issue of waiting for appeals and stuff like that. Are we certain that final court order is sufficient? I can't really remember too much of the debate we were having, but maybe it's something we can come back to it when we look at that deletion of the words unless an appeal has been lodged. Is satisfy any judgment order given, and we've deleted judgment and put in final court order, and then later on with 30 days of the order becoming final unless an appeal has been lodged, we've deleted the references to appeal. So presumably because the intention is that final court order means that there's no appeals or reviews.
Chairperson, yes. If we look at the definition of final court order on page 11 of this document, it provides given or confirmed by a court of final instance number one, and two, given by any other court where the time for noting an appeal against judgment has expired and no appeal has been lodged. So I think that definition covers the whole issue, because surely a court order won't be final, can't be final, if an appeal has been lodged. And that's why you will see, Chairperson, on the next page, we'll get there. One of the commentators also reset. Final court order against the department must be satisfied within 30 days of the order becoming final, and then we had in the bill as initially introduced, unless an appeal has been lodged. But one of the commentators who submitted comments at the committee's invitation indicated that those words are not necessary, because the definition of final court order already covers that issue. So personally, I think that our definition of final court order covers all the possible scenarios.
What about review?
Chairperson, at one of our previous meetings we also had this discussion, and I think eventually it was decided that review is included, because again, if you look at the definition of final court order, given or confirmed by a court of final instance. So if there's a review, and maybe the state attorney and Mr. Kuala can assist me here, but if there's a review, there cannot be an order given or confirmed by a court of final instance. That can only happen after the review has been dealt with.
My worry is, okay, you talk about confirmed by court of final instance. Well, that's the appeal SCA or constitutional court. Then you go on specifically under B on the definition of final court order to talk about appeals and the times for appeals. So it seems odd that there's no mention of review.
Mm-hmm.
we had a discussion about this, and I think if I recall correctly, the periods for review were not as specified or as strict, and we said review can still happen at any time, we can still get condemnation for all those kind of things. So we only had that specific time limit for the appeal, and once that has elapsed, it's regarded as final, even if you can still get condemnation for an appeal later on. But the review proceedings were far more open-ended, which is why we could never end up having a final court order, as far as I remember.
Now you have to have a final court order before you can start the attachment proceedings. What happens, and it's a final court order, the period of appeal has passed, etc. But what happens is whilst the proceedings have started, the government department takes a decision on review. We may then need a clause, and that should suspend the execution proceedings. And we may need a clause to that effect. So maybe it doesn't come in here, but it would come in as a sort of defense to attachment proceedings.
I think that's worth looking at, but my concern is that it will be abused by the government departments. You know, as soon as they get an attachment warrant of execution issued, then they're going to go run and get a review on the judgment. So I think we need to look at that very carefully.
Look, I mean, there may be abuses, but then they'll get whacked for costs orders and they won't succeed if it's being abused. But the problem is, in a genuine case where something did fall between the cracks and nobody knew about it, it was served on the wrong person, they didn't know about the default judgment. I mean, if there's a genuine case for review, it can't be stopped. So. To suspend the attachment.
Mr. Chairman, I think we must always be alive to the fact that we're dealing with a situation where there are two litigants in an unequal position. One with absolutely deep pocket and often very little scruples, and somebody else on the other side. What John says is technically correct, but there is the notion of encouraging or action. If the provisions is made for a review which is otherwise provided for elsewhere, now people go through the act and they find the next section and we're almost prompt to lodge one next step to try to delay liability. The notion that we've been pursuing is that of keeping the judgment creditor against the a person other than the state on the same basis as the judgment creditor of the state. So if we pursue this notion, all we would need to say, I think, is an order of court capable of execution. If it is capable of execution under ordinary circumstances, we don't want to make it any different when a person reaches the point of having an order of court capable of execution against the state.
Thanks. I think let's go back and see whether both issues, particularly the one question raised by Honourable Mr. Jeffries about the review applications, whether they're adequately covered under the definition of a final court order. As it stands now, the definition of a final court order, it presupposes all proceedings that ought to have been instituted before a final court is issued that order has elapsed, has come, has gone. That's how the definition stands. And what we have done, we've looked at all civil appeals from high courts, from lower courts, and the rules with regard to that. For example, if you institute review proceedings for the decision of the federal courts, there are no time stipulations. There's no time frames, basically. But if you look at, in particular, Rule 53 applications, there's no time. You can bring it at any time. You can bring it any time through those proceedings. So, in other words, there's no time specifically in the review. But as long as that application has not been brought into Rule 53, it still stands as a final court order. Thanks.
Yeah, look, I'm not asking for proposing for review to be included under the definition of final court order. I don't think it would fit there. What I'm raising, and I can raise it again then when we get to that section, is that the institution of review proceedings to suspend attachment. So it could come there, because the difficulty with the let me just raise it there, because I mean final court order is given or confirmed by a court of final instance. That is basically the Supreme Court of Appeal. Okay, that's all, or the Constitutional Court. Okay, but an order given by does not include orders from the Magistrates Court. Okay, because it's not a court of final instance. Then it's given by any other court where the time for noting an appeal against the judgment has expired. Okay, so review is not covered, but I see the point. I'm not saying it should be under final court order, but I think we should look at it as if review proceedings are instituted, and I'll raise it in that section.
May I inquire? What's wrong with the expression, a court or order capable of execution? Because the last thing we want to do is to create language which in any way can be construed of creating a category of orders capable of executions different from the state than for any other member of the public when dealing with entities which are not the state.
Look, that one really, because I mean, an order by the magistrate's court is capable of execution, and you then may decide you want to appeal, and the period hasn't elapsed. So I think final court order is fine as it is. I think the other thing we've got to also remember is just coming out of the experience of dealing with a relatively clear law, the Municipal Electoral Act, and presiding officers and in voting stations, and an inability in some cases to understand what was quite clear. So you've got to be doubly clear.
Chair, I don't think the statement is correct to say that the Magistrates Court is not a court of final instance, because it could be if there is no appeal. So, but my concern is that, you know, why are we still trying to protect the state? Once you've executed, you've gone through however many court processes, you've gone through and notifying the department. They've had however many days to satisfy the judgment. If they then, only after that, then we start executing. And I saw until after suspension of the process when they decide they want to review the matter. If they haven't decided to renew the matter after all of that, why should they then be protected? Well, if they didn't know about it, then that's even worse. And I mean, we're here to protect the poor judgment creditors who are in an unequal position.
But Chair, sorry. Magistrates Court is not a final court in terms of this definition. It's not a court of final instance, because it refers to the Magistrate Court is under B, given by any other court. That's a Magistrates Court where the time for noting an appeal has expired. So magistrates, high courts are covered by B. But anyway, I don't know if we need to belabor the point. I think let the definition of final court order and the stand. And I'll raise the issues. We can debate the issues on whether repeal is a ground for suspending the attachment proceedings. But you don't, it shouldn't be included in, this is all about how you start the proceedings, that a final court order must have been given, and that it's a court of final instance or any other court where an appeal has not been lodged.
Appropriate time, okay. Nomval, did you want to come in?
Yeah, this point. Yeah.
Hang on, Dr. Singh. Are you withdrawing?
No.
You're okay?
I'm okay.
All right. Thanks. Dr. Singh, why don't you proceed, actually?
Okay, I'll do this quickly. I know that it's not popular, but it's my usual point on the fact that I'm very much against continuing the ill-advised tradition of changing all the shells into must, which eliminates a fundamental semantic difference from the use of the language, impair the understanding of philosophy, and impoverish the cultural background of a nation.
Well,
a nation that may grow to understand the difference between Kant and Schopenhauer, Beethoven and Brahms, which is predicated on the difference between these two worlds.
So, Chairperson, please assist me at this point in time. Yeah. There's no decision we will discuss further when we get to the revenue clause.
Because the children are in class, sitting in family time.
Yeah, I'm talking about this issue of the definition of final court order.
Chair, just fine. Agreement with final court order defined as it is now. The section I was concerned about on review would belong in a different section if it is agreed to. But so this is fine. Nothing to come back on.
Thank you, Chairperson. So let's then proceed. We are now on page 4 of my document. Page 4, yes. So process-wise, the moment when the summons or notice has been issued, the plaintiff or applicant must give a copy to the state attorney. State attorney will then, although it's not provided here, state attorney will then inform the relevant department. If we then go to page 4 top, we provide that the state attorney or attorney of record appearing on behalf of the state, because remember, some state departments use private attorneys, but not necessarily state attorneys. That attorney must, within 7 days of the order becoming final, in writing inform the executive authority, which is the minister, and the accounting officer, which is the DG, of the department concerned, as well as the treasury of the final court order. That is within 7 days after the order has become final. What then happens is within 30 days after the order has become final, in other words, that will then give the State Department 30 minus 7 is 23. So that will give the State Department 23 days, and I'm now at subsection 3A, 23 days to either satisfy the debt or to enter or make arrangements with the creditor to pay at the later stage. So there are two options: you either pay or you make arrangements. Then 3B provides that the accounting officer must make that payment within those two time frames. That's 3B1. In other words, we first say it must be paid, and then we place the obligation on the accounting officer, who will eventually take responsibility to ensure that the amount or the debt has been satisfied. 3B subsection 2 provides that such payment must be charged against the appropriated budget of the department concerned. You will see we have there deleted the words all expenditure budget. Apparently that, according to the Treasury, it's not necessary. And as a result thereof, I have a meeting this morning with the state law advisors. And as a result of that deletion, we decided that the words were applicable at the end of that paragraph should also be deleted. So those are, there's nothing new there as introduced. Chairperson, now we get to the whole process where Treasury is involved, and maybe with your permission I should ask them to take us through all those processes, because those are provisions which they have proposed, and I think they will be in a better position to sort of explain how it's going to work in practice.
sorry, Mr. Chairman, about doing this to you and to everyone else, but there is a point and limit that I need to raise before we get into this section. This act, the State Liability Act, applies to the state. The state has organs. Organs of state are defined in Section 259 of the Constitution, if memory does not fail me, as anything established under the law or under the Constitution or exercising public powers. So, as we know, the Natal Shark Board is an organ of state. The Reserve Bank is an organ of state. So the State Liability Act, unless we insert something else, will apply to the very large number of organs of state, many of which, most of which, do not have an executive authority but for purpose of the PMFA, may not have treasuries, and may not necessarily justify an exemption of attachment of immovable property. So this is something that has been bothering me during the election period. I'm not sure whether I'm taking deliberations back, but as I read,
Dr. Machine.
Yeah, but what happens then to the other organs of state? I see it, General Smart is referring me to page 12. What happens to the organs of state? Can we overrule Section 259 of the Constitution? Okay, if you're happy, then it's fine.
Chair, may I just perhaps at this stage mention that fairly recently we picked up that there are a number of acts of Parliament creating structures and institutions and organs, probably those organs that the Honourable Member is referring to. And in those acts, it is specifically stated that the State Liability Act will apply to those organs. Now, it then appears that any amendment to the State Liability Act, such as the amendments that we are dealing with now, will then also apply to those organs of state. And to my mind, and we've debated this, that is correct. That is how it should be. But we also then notice that in some of these acts they still refer to a minister. While you will recall, in our new State Liability Act, we refer to the executive authority. So what we will do is we will bring in an amendment in the State Liability Bill to provide that in all these acts where it is referred to, where they refer to minister, it will be interpreted to mean the executive authority of that particular structure. We will draft something along those lines and we will let you have it.
Thanks, Chair. Previously, I think we did engage or discuss a bit in terms of whether the amendments that we're working on, do they only apply provincial government or national government? We then looked into the definition of organs of state as defined in Section 239 of the Constitution. And then we said, for purpose of this exercise and amendments, we're trying to comply with a court, constitutional court order with respect to the judgment. And paragraph 13A specifically says, if the final court order against a national or provincial department, that's what they agree. But I take Jan's point in that we need to look at other pieces of legislation that make reference to the State Liability Act as we'll amend it. My second point, Chair, on four, just a change there is that on top, the state attorney or the attorney of record appearing on behalf of the department. I suggest that we remove appearing on behalf of the department because the attorney of record appears on behalf of the department. He is an attorney of record in any event.
The point is a deleting of record. You see, we wanted to make a distinction between the state attorney and private attorneys, mm-hmm. or any, maybe it should be any other attorney appearing on behalf of the department concerned.
The word attorney of record, it covers that aspect. Particularly because we've added attorney of record, rather state attorney, because we're mindful that other state departments are using private attorneys. So once, whether it's a private attorney, but if it's an attorney of record in that particular matter, he represents that particular state department, whether it's private, particularly it's private, because it's a record representing that client in that particular point.
Should be any other attorney of record because the state attorney is but it's also, you know, it's also, I don't see any harm with appearing on behalf of the department concerned because it then clarifies it's a private attorney, and this is meant to sort of be sort of relatively easy reading. The only change I would have seen is state attorney. Because the state attorney is also an attorney of record appearing on behalf of the department, we put the word other in, or any other attorney of record appearing on behalf of the department concerned. But the thing I wanted to raise was the issue of Mr. Rudman's point and Mr. Gaula's. We're setting up an elaborate procedure. We're giving a lot of responsibilities on Treasury. I don't think we've then also got the problem of we were specifically excluding local government because local government was excluded from the final order. I don't think our intention is to provide this procedure for other bodies. You know, so why must the provincial or the national treasury be worried about the fact that the Voortrekker Museum in Pietermaritzburg, which is an organ of state, didn't pay its debts and now has a costs order against it? They must somehow go and attach the Church of the Vow. Well, maybe that's not the best thing, but... No, I mean, maybe that's... But it's basically... I would have thought that other bodies should not have the protection